presents kind of, you know, urgent risks to our traditional resources, food that our citizens depend on.
Ketchikan's tribe hopes federal funds can offset impacts from climate change. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, November 25th. Good evening, I'm Wesley Early. Also tonight, Juneau's food bank continues to see high demand after a pandemic spike.
And I really appreciate being able to get it because we're all squeezed with fixed income.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Sneezing, aching, sweating, and coughing. Who has the time for this misery? You have the power to protect yourself and your community. Boost your defenses this season by getting the flu vaccine. Protect yourself and family. Learn more at vaccinate.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health.
Republicans hold 21 of the 40 seats in the Alaska House of Representatives after the first full run of Alaska's new ranked choice voting system. As reported by the Alaska Beacon, the 21-person total includes two candidates who had been trailing before votes were tabulated Wednesday evening. Incumbent Republican Representative Tom McKay of Anchorage trailed Democrat Denny Wells entering the day, but now leads Wells by four votes in the state's closest race. In East Anchorage, Republican Julie Coulomb leads nonpartisan candidate Walter Featherly after trailing him at the start of the day. The results are unofficial, and the Division of Elections expects to certify them on November 29th. Recounts are possible. State law allows a losing candidate to request one in any race, but the candidate must pay for the recount unless the result is within 0.5%. In the Alaska Senate, former Senate President Kathy Geisel, a Republican from Anchorage, will return to office after defeating incumbent Republican Senator Roger Holland, the man who defeated her in 2020. She was among 11 Republicans elected to the 20-person Senate. Four of those Republicans, including Geisel, were elected despite the disapproval of local party officials who preferred other Republican candidates. Moderate Republicans, including Geisel, are expected in coming days or weeks to announce the formation of a coalition Senate majority that includes the Senate's nine Democrats. Meanwhile, tribes around Alaska are trying to find ways to stop climate change from eroding their ways of life, like access to traditional foods, clean waterways, and infrastructure in small villages. The Bureau of Indian Affairs recently announced more than $45 million in federal grant money for tribes around the country to address issues spurred by climate change. More than a third of that is making its way to Alaska, which has the largest number of federally recognized tribes in the country. KRBD's Reagan Miller reports.
Alaska is warming up faster than any other part of the U.S. The change in climate has left communities to reckon with problems ranging from eroding shorelines and riverbanks to bacteria-infested waterways. The Biden administration's climate action grants are partially funded by last year's landmark bipartisan infrastructure law. They're intended to give tribes an infusion of cash to put towards projects that'll help fend off the worst of the impacts. In Southeast, there's a lot of pressure on making sure vital waterways stay clean and subsistence foods remain available. Ketchikan Indian Community was awarded nearly $250,000 to keep working on the goals outlined in its climate action plan. Tribal officials say it's the federally recognized tribe's biggest federal climate grant yet. Tony Gallegos, the tribe's cultural resources director, says climate change threatens the indigenous way of life.
Well, it presents kind of, you know, urgent risks to our traditional resources, food that our citizens depend on.
And part of preserving the way of life is understanding the role of traditional foods. So the tribe plans to, among other things, interview local elders about what traditional food sources are most important to them. Gallegos says that effort is already underway.
We've already made some significant headway in gathering and documenting tribal citizen reliance on traditional food and priorities, with over 320 responses to our initial survey last year.
Some of the grant money also will be used to collect bacteria samples from local waters. The tribe has been monitoring bacteria levels at local beaches since 2017, and evidence seems to point to spikes after big rainstorms.
Sometimes they call the first flush after a rainfall event, especially when there hasn't been rain for a while, can often carry pollutants into, in this case, the Narrows, where we know we have bacteria problems. So we want to start to collect some water quality right after those rainfall events.
Gallego says they hope to test at least 10 samples over the next 2 years. Another $15,000 was awarded to the tribe to fund travel expenses for staff to attend conferences to learn about other ways to adapt to a changing climate. Further north, the Yakutat-Tlingit tribe plans to use a grant of nearly $114,000 to help deepen local knowledge about tribal lands using LIDAR mapping technology. That'll allow the tribe to conduct detailed aerial surveys of its lands. Andrew Gildersleeve is the tribe's executive director.
So LIDAR is a very exciting way for us to map with precision tribal lands as they are. And this is creating a record for us and a baseline for us to use in the future, and we hope for future generations to be able to establish and recognize trends.
With LIDAR, Gildersleeve says the tribe can learn more about rising ocean levels, salmon habitat, and tidal zones. The tribe's grant consultant, Amanda Bremner, says the project will be completed in 3 phases, and it might even help broaden ancestral knowledge.
We have an indigenous and traditional place name map that for years has just been, you know, a map on the wall drawn of boundaries and areas from a time, you know, decades ago, that in this ever-changing climate may not necessarily be accurate. So we're looking forward to having these high-resolution images.
Elsewhere in the state, a handful of villages received funding to seek higher ground as they face increasingly brutal storms and erosion. That includes Unalakleet. With around 100 people, it's the largest community to receive a grant dedicated to what's called a managed retreat from the shore of Norton Sound. The local tribe received nearly $300,000 to move the village to a nearby hillside. Carrie Duame is the housing director for Unalakleet's tribe. She says an old seawall that surrounds the silty spit that the village sits on spared it from the worst of the damage from ex-Typhoon Murbach in September. But she says it's clear the village has to move further from shore to survive the new climate reality.
Ground itself can be unstable for the style of building that and the era of building that a lot of the houses are from. Just like the 70s, 80s, some even earlier, like the 40s and 50s. And more concerning, the seawall probably isn't sufficient in the long run.
She says a retreat from the shore would also give the village room to expand.
Also, there's very little land to build on. Left, it's like pretty crowded.
Duame says the plan is in its early stages. She says the tribe's next goal for this grant is to get a completed plan ready for another grant proposal next year. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Reagan Miller.
Juneau police have arrested a man in connection with the killing of Faith Rogers. Her body was found on the Kaktagoo Hinde or Brotherhood Bridge Trail back in September. Anthony Michael Migliaccio was arrested in Juneau on Thursday evening under an warrant for first-degree murder, according to a police press release. Police say the arrest took place in the 2000 block of Lemon Creek Road, which is consistent with the address for Lemon Creek Correctional Center. According to court records, a man with the same birthday and a similar name, Anthony Michael Migliaccio, with an extra I, made a plea agreement in Juneau on Wednesday in trespassing and harassment cases. But no one at the Juneau Police Department was available today to confirm if the cases are related or if they are the same person with different spellings. The Juneau Police Department has released very few details in the 2 months since Rogers was found dead. Her body was sent to Anchorage for an autopsy, scheduled for a few days after her death, but no information about how she died has been released. Migliaccio is being held at Lemon Creek Correctional Center on $500,000 bail. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, residents in St. George emerge from almost a month of no running water.
Trying to find a friend's house that has a good supply of running water so I can borrow their shower just to go bathe my family.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
What if accessing your personal and family immunization records was as easy as checking your phone? The Docket app is a secure option that allows Alaskans to quickly access their immunization records. Need immunization records for school or travel? Docket makes it simple and is available for download from the App Store or Google Play Store. Learn more at vaccinationrecords.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health.
The pandemic more than doubled the number of patrons at Juneau's main food bank. And even after nearly 3 years, that spike hasn't waned. KTOO's Claire Strumpel reports.
Claudia, Chris, and a friend are picking out some dairy from one of the food-laden carts in front of the Southeast Alaska Food Bank warehouse.
Cheese, 2% low-fat.
Okay. Chris is part of a long but fast-moving line. The pandemic more than doubled the food bank's patrons.
And I really appreciate being able to get it because we're all squeezed with fixed income. So I'm 71 and I'm happy to get it.
Ken Garrison is picking up food for some elderly friends who don't have cars. He comes in twice a week.
So, and there's a ton of this today.
He picks up some candy corn left over from Halloween but puts it back.
Ken, you need a pet food today?
Yeah, I'll take a dog food.
Just dog food?
Yeah, sure, thanks.
That's Chris Schaap, offering dog food, a popular item. He's run the food bank for the last 3 years. He says when he started, the bank would serve up to 90 people a week.
Over the last 2 years with COVID, it's been between 225, 275 a week.
The number hasn't gone down. When another food pantry began closing its doors this month, the number bumped up a little more.
And then just last week, we noticed with Helping Hands closing down, we were about 35 to 40 people more than we've been averaging, almost 300.
He says inflation is likely a factor in the demand. The food bank has been open fewer than 20 minutes. Chef checks his count. They served more than 100 people.
So it's busy and we'll take care of everybody we need to. Just make it happen.
Reporting in Juneau, I'm Claire Strumpel.
Pleasant Valley Two Rivers residents have voted to create a fire service area. It's a milestone for people who live along Chena Hot Springs Road, east of Fairbanks, where a string of arson attacks in 2021 inspired locals to organize a volunteer fire department. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, administrative steps need to be completed before fire service begins July 1st of next year.
Results from a November 15th election conducted by the Fairbanks North Star Borough show 149 votes in favor and 92 against a proposal to create a fire service area between Chena Hot Springs Road, miles 12 and 27. Pleasant Valley Two Rivers Fire Association President Michelle Ethan says the next step is selecting local residents to serve on a fire service area commission.
They fill out an application. If there is more than seven, then there is a process for selecting, but up to seven, then the mayor can just appoint.
Ethan says the commissioner's primary responsibility will be to establish a budget for the fire department and a property tax mill rate to cover it.
And have it ready for borough assembly approval in January.
As a potential starting point for the commission, Ethan says the Fire Association developed a $200,000 baseline operating budget, which would result in an additional $1.5 million annual property tax.
So a house and property worth $200,000 is looking at about a $300 increase.
Tax revenue will be used to contract with the local volunteer fire department to provide service beginning July 1st, 2023. Ethan says the department, which began organizing following a string of arson attacks in the summer of 2021, has spent the last 16 months getting ready, including gathering donated equipment.
We've been the beneficiary of so many departments that have, I think, because of the circumstance that happened in Two Rivers, have been wonderful and have donated so much.
Ethan says fire service will have the added benefit of increasing the number of companies that offer fire insurance in the area and lowering rates. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Major river systems in Southeast Alaska start across the U.S.-Canada border, and natural resource development in the transboundary watersheds can have serious effects hundreds of miles away. As KSTK's Sage Smiley reports, more than a dozen Southeast Alaska tribal governments and councils are asking the Canadian government to recognize their sovereignty and give them a seat at the decision-making table when natural resource development could impact the communities downstream.
The ever-shifting tidal flats of the Stikine River Delta are peppered with weathered tree trunks, the root systems sticking up like another small forest. For centuries, the Shtachin, the bitter water, and the surrounding land was the territory of chief sheikhs. The tidal passed through generations of leaders of the Stikine Tlingit people. The 1971 Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act extinguished what it called Aboriginal title to the land, water, hunting, and fishing rights.
I call it the failed experiment.
Rob Sanderson is the chair of the Southeast Alaska Indigenous Transboundary Commission, or SEITC, a consortium of 15 Southeast tribal governments which aims to protect rivers that sustain communities and culture in Southeast. He's standing on the back deck of a jet boat, idling just past the Stikine Delta.
Now we're all at the table like this.
Although Southeast Alaska's Tlingit, Haida, and Tsimshian people are part of the same indigenous groups that exist just a few miles upriver in Canada, Alaska Native people aren't recognized as sovereign nations by Canada's government. The jet boat is carrying a cross-border group of environmental advocates and tribal leaders upriver. Today's focus is the Stikine, the fastest-flowing navigable river in North America. It was named one of the 10 most endangered rivers in America by nonprofit environmental organization American Rivers in 2019 because of the potential impacts from mine development.
Everything we protect is pretty pretty amazing to get, you know, like up with what we're up against.
Haida leader Guja, who goes by his mononymous Khadkil name, also stands on the back deck.
But yet, for our own people at the village level, it's not a gain. It's just really, it's just preventing a loss. So we're not gaining anything. You know, people look and see that the trees over there are still there, or they're in it. But that's how it's been forever. So we didn't gain anything by it.
The commission is seeking what's called the right of consent for Southeast tribes in the permitting process for a dozen operating and proposed mines in British Columbia. It's a higher status than they're currently afforded by the BC government and would allow Southeast Alaska Native people the same rights as First Nations when it comes to free, prior, and informed consent about the impacts of proposed mines. Kirby Muldo, whose Gixan name is Hapwalaksa, works with Skeena Wild, a Canadian conservation trust.
As we say about salmon, you know, they know no borders.
Standing on a sandy riverbank, Trixie Bennett says Tlingit creation stories center on the waterways of modern-day British Columbia and Southeast Alaska. Bennett says her people have held the river in high esteem for generations, but they didn't do it alone.
This trip today is just another step towards reuniting with our cousins up the river. I'm a Tlingit Tahltan, and up there are the Tahltan Tlingits.
Another few miles upriver and through a winding slough, pale blue icebergs start to dot the water. It's an opportunity to take some photos.
Iceberg right behind
here,
us
right
now.
Here, right there.
All right, got you guys. Lean in a little bit. Up.
In front of Shakes Glacier, named for the seven Tlingit chiefs of Wrangell who bore the name Chief Shakes, group members share songs and stories. Like glaciers throughout the world, this one is spectacular and a visible reminder of the changing climate. The face of the glacier has retreated miles down the lake in the last few decades. The mood is exuberant and determined. For some on the trip, it's their first time up the Stikine. For others, it's a part of home. Aksin Esther Reese is the tribal administrator for Wrangell's tribal government, the Wrangell Cooperative Association.
When I'm on the river, I can feel our ancestors with us, and I imagine them paddling down these rivers. And it is so extremely important for us to protect the rivers, to have co-management with our brothers and sisters in Canada. And yeah, we have been here since time immemorial, and we've always taken care of the land and will continue to do so.
For now, the commission's focus is on getting Southeast tribes participating First Nation status in the Eskay Creek Revitalization Project, the proposed reopening of a metals mine in the Unik watershed. The draft environmental assessment for the project will come within the next year or two, and at that point, it will be more clear whether BC will allow Southeast tribes a seat at the table. In Wrangell, I'm Sage Smiley.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the Westmark Fairbanks Hotel and Conference Center, offering guests hot breakfast, Wi-Fi, and the Red Lantern Steak and Spirits Restaurant. Reservations at westmarkhotels.com.
Sneezing, aching, sweating, and coughing. Who has the time for this misery? You have the power to protect yourself and your community. Boost your defenses this season by getting the flu vaccine. Protect yourself and family.
Learn more at vaccinate.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health.
The small Pribilof Island community of St. George is especially grateful this Thanksgiving. The community went almost a month without running water after a breakdown in its water system. As KNBO's Jill Freitas tells us, everyone is happy to have it back on tap in time for the holidays.
Back on October 22nd, water pressure suddenly dropped and the water was unfit to drink.
It's been pretty murky. It's brown. Even boiling, you don't trust to use it for washing dishes.
Anastasia Kashaverov says supplies of bottled water went fast. Some homes were unaffected, but most had to haul 5-gallon buckets of water from the public safety building to their homes to flush toilets and mop the floors. As a working mom and mother of two, it became difficult to keep up with it all.
Trying to find a friend's house that has a good supply of running water so I can borrow their shower just to go bathe my family.
Tribes, Native corporations, and other groups donated bottled water, which helped. But as the days wore on, there was no relief in sight. The city crew still couldn't pinpoint the leak. Mark Merkulieff, the mayor of St. George, says the source of the leak remained a mystery until November 16th, when water engineers arrived to help track it down.
We've narrowed it down to a break, like a 1-inch line to one of the old houses.
So what caused the break in the line? When the crew dug into the ground, they were shocked at what they found, a clean break in the pipe that was right on top of a huge rock. Merkulieff began to wonder if the line was damaged in an earthquake that gave St. George a stiff jolt just a few days before the water system failed.
The way the break was, you couldn't have had a cleaner cut go through there, so I thought, wow, it wouldn't take much for this to break of the amount of stress that it was under.
It took a day to repair the line, but the problems aren't over yet. The Environmental Conservation Department issued a boil water notice. Cindy Christian, a drinking water program manager for DEC, says it takes time to lift an order.
Anytime a water pipe is opened, we want to make sure that it's disinfected after it's fixed. And so they'll be running some chlorine through the system to disinfect the water lines, and then they'll be flushing that out. And then they will collect 3 samples, and they'll send those into the laboratory to be analyzed. And as soon as we get 3 satisfactory samples, we'll be able to lift a boil water notice as long as they maintain pressure.
And while it may be a while for things to go completely back to normal, Anastasia Kashaverov says she feels grateful to the city crew and engineers for their hard work.
I know it's frustrating for everyone in the community, especially the city workers trying to resolve this issue.
As for the mayor, he sees the incident as a learning experience.
You got to know the ins and outs of your systems here, and that's a great way to learn it. Also, to be able to, in the future, in meetings with whether it's state agencies or federal agencies, be able to explain situations like that.
The exact cause of the waterline failure may never be known, but the community of 35 does know one thing, that challenges like this have a way of bringing people together. In Anchorage, I'm Jill Freitas.
As holidays go, Thanksgiving is fairly new. There was a time when there was no designated day to give thanks, when giving thanks was a part of daily life. KNBA's Rhonda McBride takes a look at how Alaska Native languages offer a window not just into the past, but into humanity and the spirituality of gratitude.
Kuyana, 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 te luchi.
You're listening to a song from the Aleutic Elders Academy called Kuyana, which means thank you. It's also the same word in the Yupik language, or Yuktun.
Kuyana.
For Asikayakayak, Kuyana is a word with deeper layers of meaning, one with roots from a culture of sharing food gathered from the land and the sea. Ossie grew up near Bethel in Shefornik, where, as a small child, he absorbed the true meaning of Kuyana.
As I got older, I was able to help my father more, and I watched him butcher seals that my brothers have caught, and then he would hand me the choice parts, which are the shoulders of the seal, and he would say, Kita, give these to these elders.
As he carried the seal meat to his elders, Ossie remembers how his hands were full and how his heart overflowed with joy.
And I gently used my feet to knock on their door, and they would open up, and then they would, Allah, Alingarin Kakuya Nakfa, oh my, thank you so much.
Goodness, cheese.
Hune Lance Twitchell has dedicated his life to spreading knowledge about the languages and cultures of Southeast Alaska, where he teaches Tlingit.
I think the word has an ancient origin. There's a related verb, which would be like chichish, which would be for something to be possible. And so you could say something like, Achtuch chichish, I believe it's possible.
As if to say, it wouldn't be possible without you. And that, says Hune, is more than just gratitude, but a form of acknowledgement.
Some of our elders, like the late Kingisti David Kansik, used to talk about the power of this phrase and how much emphasis and love you could put into it, sometimes by dragging out that last syllable, goodness, cheese.
It isn't just a casual thank you. It's masicho. It means so much to me, your kindness.
Kay Wallace is Gwich'in, a traditional healer who believes Masi Cho carries great spiritual energy. She says her people's long history has shown that gratitude helps to heal from sickness and trauma and also survive hard times.
I'm 78, and so when I talk about my elders, most of them have passed, but they all remember hunger. They remember the starvation period. And then when somebody would just share a bone with them, a moose bone, caribou bone, or a piece of fish, masicho.
Wallace says most of us today have never known such hardship and the importance of sharing what little you may have to give.
Masicho. It meant so much. You're keeping me alive. You're keeping my family alive. Thank you. Thank you from my heart.
She says there was a time when gratitude was a way of life.
You thank the sun for coming up, for going down. Thank you for the light. You're so grateful for the light. Thank you, Creator. Masicho, Creator.
Wallace says Thanksgiving is a forerunner of the solstice on December 21st, when the light returns. Light that radiates in words like Masicho or Goyana. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride. Gunashish.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Reagan Miller in Ketchikan, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Jennifer Pemberton and Claire Strumpel in Juneau, Jill Freitas and Rhonda McBride in Anchorage, and Sage Smiley in Wrangell. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde. Annie Fight produced tonight's program, and I'm Wesley Early. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the Westmark Fairbanks Hotel and Conference Center, located in downtown Fairbanks with 400 guest rooms and 1,700 square feet of meeting space. Reservations at westmarkhotels.com. The IBEW is the union of skilled hands and generous hearts, hardworking people on the job and off. It's the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, the IBEW. This message sponsored by the IBEW Local 1547.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.